Rex, welcome again to our fourth teleconference together. We're starting a trend here, and we've got some amazing calls under our belt, so to speak. And it's been exciting to see that people are downloading them and sending their comments and questions and great feedback and positive responses. People are very excited about hearing from you after a decade of you away from the field of NLP, but off doing other things like indie filmmaking and entertainment and all that. And our first three calls really explored some very high-level topics from the grand scheme of things. And in fact, just to comment on our high-level calls, so pleased to hear your comments on the big chunk as to why it's so wonderful to keep your eye on the bigger rewards as opposed to the smaller chunk. And I also have been getting questions that are very small chunk oriented. And we certainly know, I think both you and I would agree, that lots of people tend to ask a lot of small chunk questions about what a specific skill can get them, or in terms of the little chunk rewards, and what specific exercises could someone do, or what kinds of ways could people use their skills to test things out or enhance their skills or get specific smaller chunk results. I think it's nice that we cover a lot of different bases and that we explore things from different perspectives, and tonight's call is going to be drilling down a bit more into some detail. So in doing so, I thought it might be valuable both from a listener perspective and from our perspective to give some examples of how much truly goes into the effective construction of learning experiences in an NLP course. Now, to begin with, I'm coming from the perspective of not only having been training for 15 years and studying my own craft, which is, of course, following on from watching you do your genius work in terms of how you moved audiences and helped guide people in their own journeys. And I have these two different positions, these two different perspectives. I have the perspective of a trainer. I have the perspective of the student. And, of course, you do as well. In particular, I have the unique perspective of having been your student and also being able to process what I was observing in your behavior as I learned what worked for me and what didn't work for me as I evolved in my own journey as a trainer. So those two different perspectives are constantly informing the choices that I make at the front of the room. And that's something I'd like to touch on later in the call as well, is these multiple perspectives. So that's just a data point. And I know from having had long conversations with you, some of which went late into the night, that a great deal does go into how you create learning environments and experiences. And, of course, since training with you in 97, I have gone through a lot of explorations as to how I wanted to create similar and also unique learning experiences for students. So many, many different things have informed my journey, and I know at least as many, perhaps a different set of experiences and explorations have informed your journey. Some of the things I'd like to touch on in the beginning of the call, and I'd like you to add some if you think they're relevant, of course, is that there's a variety of different skills or schools of thought for accelerated learning that create profound learning in a short period of time, amongst other things. You have created a method of teaching or training that you call mind design. I definitely want to ask you more about that. Also, I think anyone who's been involved in NLP circles, NLP training circles especially, for any period of time, would have heard the phrase discovery method. And anyone who searched around on it on Google will probably know that there's not a whole lot for that term available. But it's been bandied about left and right. And I have my sense of what it is, and we can talk about how that may have informed our own training experiences. There's also, of course, Bernice McCarthy's format method. And the format method is often used in a lot of different training circles, certainly NLP training circles, because it gives a wide array of different ways of expressing and sharing ideas and skills to a wide array of different audiences. So if you happen to use the format method to deliver technical information to a crowd, chances are everyone in the audience is going to get something from that. So the format method is this great approach to ensuring that everyone walks away with something from a talk. Then, of course, there's whole brain learning, things like educational kinesiology. The trademark version of that is EduK, but, of course, we know it as cross-crawling. And and how that helps optimize mental processing as people are learning, optimizing brain states. Many people who have any knowledge of accelerated learning know that the brain learns by sequence. So I have to share in advance that I'm a huge fan of your masterful work in sequencing skills, knowledge, etc., and weaving the development of an experience into something that is more rich. And I have certainly at least aimed to stand on the shoulders of genius there. I certainly count you as a strong influence in terms of how I sequence learning experiences. So that's how I'd like to start things off. It's just a quick discussion of, to the degree that we can do it quickly, of how all of these different things contribute to profound learning experiences. Could we start there?
We can.
So maybe you could share with us a bit about mind design.
Well, I mean, mind design was my approach to learning, and it was the way that I ran things through my filter, whole brain learning, accelerated learning, NLP, other meditation, other disciplines besides NLP, things that I came up with on my own. And it really represents my journey in understanding how to assist myself or others in not only acquiring information, but behavioral flexibility and behavioral skills and variety. So I also feel that not a whole lot of, and NLP has been kind of, you know, pour it into the funnel and chunk it down thing. If you think of a funnel, you know, you've got a big end at one side and a tiny end at the other side, and everything seems to be, you know, how do we get everything down to the smallest, most minute detail? And that's okay, you know, it's like examining it bit by bit. Like if you took a BART, a bicycle, you could say, you know, here's the seat, and here's the chain, and here's the wheels, and you could talk about their function and what they do and all that kind of stuff. But that's one way of approaching it. The other way of approaching it is to have the bicycle and then figure out what it does when it's all together, and to use it when it's all together. And by using it when it's all together, then determine, okay, what are the elements that go into it. You're still kind of chunking it down, but you're starting from a slightly different point of view, at least in my opinion. You're looking at the big picture and trying to find out what elements contribute to that, as opposed to taking the big picture. It's both the same way, and maybe I'm talking circularly right now. But the idea being that when it comes to learning, we learn things as an infant by being open and by experimentation, only we don't know we're experimenting. We do it through discovery. We do it by being curious, by crawling over to look at something that we've never seen before and getting stung by a bee or getting rewarded in some way, and we base these experiences. But we're truly, in many ways, apart from genetics and whatever other things may be present, we are pretty much an open slate. We don't judge our learnings until we get a little bit older. You know, we don't stop the learning process. We just kind of are this intake machine. The brain is just going, wow, this is all very cool. When we get to school and they sat us in chairs and told us how we had to learn things and how we had to return information to them, we ended up by being bored or angry or disappointed, or sometimes we excelled depending on our own personal learning style. Some people love it and some people don't. So the thing is how do you capture that again? How do you become that learning acquisition vehicle? How do you evolve yourself into going backwards in time, essentially, and being open enough to allow things in purely? And then, after they're in, to kind of sort through them and figure out how and where they're best utilized. Kind of like taking all your furniture from your house and taking a dump truck and dumping it into the next house. So it's all there. But then now you start putting it in the rooms and the right places and everything else. So, you know, you fill it and then you organize it. Where a lot of people try to manage what's coming in. They try and make sure, is this right or is this wrong? Am I getting it correctly? Are these the steps that I need? Or we'll break it down into all these steps. But when you do just that and you only focus on those steps, then you by necessity miss other things. I mean, especially if you believe the tenet that we delete, distort, and generalize. So by necessity, by focusing our attention in one place, we delete. And that's not a bad thing, but the key is to then change your focus so that you pick up deleted information, so that you round out your learning. And I've always felt that NLP kind of became too narrow in its own focus. I shouldn't say NLP was, I should say the way it was often presented. That people were so quick to say, look, we've got these like calibration skills, and here are the little fine pieces, or here we have metaprograms, and here's the 9,800,000th billionth metaprogram that you need to know. When, in fact, you don't. You don't need to know all these things. You know, having one little extra distinction is not going to be the distinction. It's not going to be the linchpin that everybody thinks it is, that all of a sudden everything will make sense. What's truly important is to have a couple of things that you do exquisitely well. You know, it's like if you look at great artists and talent, and whether they're musicians, whether they're athletes, whether they're actors, whether they're scientists, they don't do everything. They do one or two things really, really, really well. And the thing that I think, yeah, you know, I mean, in other words, it's the jack of all trades, master of none. Well, so what for me, what my design represented, and we've talked about this somewhat before, is master your life, you know, through learning how to be a successful learner, to be able to acquire the things that make you happy, the attitudes, the principles, the philosophies, the behaviors, the insights, the aha experiences that allow you to enjoy life to its utmost, as opposed to trying to become this like person who can see little tiny things in other people's behavior so that you can see these things. You know, the goal for me is to chunk up, not to chunk down. The goal to do is go, if you could see all these little tiny things, how does that add value to your life? You know, and to revisit the big picture, the values, the things that are important. So
I'd like to come back to that in a little later in the call. And I absolutely agree with you on all counts, and tonight is still about, let's say, satisfying some of the smaller chunk learners out there that are approaching NLP from that perspective. They may be thinking a bit in an analytical form, and we'd hope that we could inspire them to think about the much bigger picture. They may still want to know, okay, how are Rex and Jonathan effective at creating a fast track towards skills? And maybe some of the lessons that we share on tonight's call, they'll be able to apply immediately towards the kinds of tests and experiments they can create in their daily life every day. So we talked about two different perspectives before. Let's jump into how I'd like to springboard from that into deconstructing a couple of exercises.
Before you do that, let me say this. People either listen to what you say or what I say, and they go, yep, yep, that's right, absolutely, I agree. Or they go, oh, that's such BS. Who would that? Nah, that's total garbage. I don't agree with any of that. Both of those are the mind shutting down. Both of those are like a big, heavy safe door slamming shut inside the bank. The minute you agree or the minute you disagree, you have stopped the learning process. The key to the learner is to be able to allow things in without evaluating or analyzing them or agreeing or disagreeing. It's being open to it as if you were a child without the judgment process. A very difficult thing to do. But that's the point of my design in creating exercises, which is to put people into an exercise. And believe me, it's a whole lot harder to explain than it is to actually do. But you put people into exercises where they can experience things, and hopefully one of the things they experience and they learn and they begin to recognize is when they close and when they can open. And that's a challenge for me, for you, for, you know, I think everybody. Because the second you're in exercise, you go, oh, there, yeah, that's it. Okay, he was right. You've stopped seeing. You've stopped listening. You've stopped. You've gone inside. You make a mental judgment of something and you miss whatever follows, especially when it comes to calibration skills.
Oh, Rex, but it's too much work to keep thinking about this. I've got to make a judgment call.
Well, and in fact, you do, and that's part of being human. So it's not that you never do it. It's that you learn when and how to do it, that you become more of the master of choice than the victim of your own brain. And so, you know, it is this dance. You can't be open infinitely and forever. And it's important to shut down and to rest and to close off and to analyze and to do all those things. So they're both, but it's a matter of when and where that you do it and at what part in the learning process do you do it. And guess what? In the learning process, you're going to do it all the time until you learn how to suspend it for a while. And that takes calibrating yourself. That takes being, you go, you know, it's the kind of thing where you know, you go, oh, crap, now I just closed down. Oh, there I did it again. Oh, there I did it again. I did it. You know, it's almost an infinite regress until you find your way of getting out of it. And the only way you do that, and the most easily, is with a skilled mentor, somebody who can go, hey, you just closed down there. And they go, I did not. You know, they'll defend it. Or they go, oh, I did. Oh, gosh, woe is me. Oh, I'm such a bad puppy. Oh, man, I'm going to go sit in a corner and cry. And that's not the right response either. I mean, the response whenever you notice that you did something right or something wrong is, yes, congratulate yourself and nurture it. This is when in the last one of the last ones I said you don't punt the baby. You encourage and you nurture and you gently bring yourself along, because when you do that, you open yourself up to more and more of the kinds of experiences that are vital and that you want to have more of. So it is nurturing.
I wonder how many different things I might notice that I haven't yet noticed before, but, you know, won't it be cool to discover those things?
Yep. Again, you know, that's using director questions to keep your mind open, because you don't want a yes or no answer. You want an answer that leads you to discovery. And one of the things that I do like about neurolinguistic programming, the way that it was approached in the beginning, was the idea of being curious about what's going on inside of another person instead of just paying attention to what goes inside of yourself. You know, being curious about how people do things. How do people who are excellent produce the results that they produce? What's the internal mechanisms that are allowing them to do that? What's the sequence of those thoughts? What are those thoughts? Are they the pictures? Are they sounds? Are they things? Well, how are those pictures and sounds and feelings represented? In other words, what are the components that go into the pictures? And if they're having pictures, when are they having them? And how are they having them? And are they in color or black and white? I mean, it's all about being curious and being open and discovering things and noticing, guess what? Hey, you know what? I noticed that there's some patterns here. How is it that this person's able to do that? How is it that this person's able to be stuck? How do they construct that for themselves? As opposed to blaming or saying being stuck is bad or being an excellent athlete is good. How do they do that? You know, and staying open and curious. And I wonder if I'll discover something I've never, ever seen before. Because I've now, as I approach things in a new way, how many different ways could I begin to think about this differently than I have from the past? You know, and what is it that I'm not paying attention to that I haven't yet noticed, that if I were to bring my attention to that, I could begin to notice and appreciate in even grander ways? There's all sorts of ways to direct your brain, but you do it lovingly and kindly and gently. And hopefully, when you learn NLP, you learn to do that with other people as well. We don't live in a vacuum.
Thank you. So let's skip ahead to the topic of perspectives. And one of the factors that I think can be most successful in helping students have extraordinary experiences is that of having multiple perspectives. Now, in NLP, of course, we have the perceptual positions, first position, second position, third position. And I noticed, and I think your describing it to us helped, I noticed that many of the exercises that you constructed offered three different positions or roles to play in the exercise. So, for example, during a given role-playing exercise, there would be an actor and a subject role and an observer role. So this is three different specific positions within an exercise drill repetition in which to experience the exercise from three different positions. What does that do to a learner?
Well, it does great things. Think of it this way. Again, we are creatures of habit. Last time I told you, I think, you know, we think something upwards of 60,000 thoughts a day, and that 80 to 90% or more of those thoughts are the same thoughts we thought before. The notion of stereotyping, people think of stereotyping as a bad thing because it often is pejorative towards groups of people or individuals or, you know, whatever, or behaviors. But stereotyping is a function of the brain. And it is designed so that you don't have to do the same thing from start to finish every time. You can cut to the chase. It's a shortcut. And what the brain does is it learns shortcuts. You know, it develops all these neural pathways, and then it goes, pick the quickest one kind of thing. So we've all grown up favoring certain things, like whether we're right-handed or left-handed, whether we're right-footed or left-footed, whether we're right-eyed or right, you know, we have preferences. We have, you know, think about it. You go into a room and you sit into a room, you know, like a classroom. You pick your chair. And if somebody came into the classroom a day later, the next class day, and you're sitting in your chair, what'd you do? You went up and said, hey, that's my chair. You know, it's like you're not supposed to be here. It's my chair. We get so used to doing things the way we do that we don't recognize that we can do them in other ways. And what the observer and the three roles do is to allow you to shift perspective from how you normally pay attention to things and to experience things from the other way. But I'll give you a movie example, and if I've done this before, stop me. But technically in the movie business, we do 5 shots for every shot, for every scene. That's the basic 5 shots. There's what's considered a master shot, which is established. You establish the players in the room so that you know where they are, so that when they go to close-ups or when they go to other shots, you have a sense of when they're looking, you know where they're looking to. They look to their right, you know, they're looking over at Bob sitting over there or something like that, or they're looking at the clock because the clock is on that side. So you've established that. This is the same kind of shot that you would get kind of if you were sitting in a theater seat out in the middle of the movie theater and you're looking at the screen, or if you were looking at a play, it would all be taking place. It's the director's point of view, essentially, of everything happening in that moment. All right. And if you were the director, you could tell the actors do this or do that. You could direct the action. But you are not in the action. You're an observer to the action, and you're watching everything unfold. Now, in the movie business, you also then typically you move into what's called a two-shot or a close-up. So let's say I now move the camera in for, let's just go for the close-up. We'll go to 3. I go to the close-up. So now I see the face of the person that the actor's interacting with in full face. What that essentially is the point of view of that person, actor A and actor B. So if the camera's on actor A, and let's say it's a girl, so we make complete sense. It's a blonde girl named Sally, who is actor A, and the camera's on Sally with the blonde hair. And it's from Ralph's point of view. Ralph is a dark-haired gentleman. Ralph is looking at Rob's point of view of Sally. He's seeing what Sally looks like from inside his eyes, and that's what the camera's trying to convey when you go to close-up. The other person is seeing that, unless there's nobody in the room, and then it's for a whole other purpose. Now, then you do a close-up of Ralph from Sally's point of view. So she now sees it. It's a change of perspective. Now, imagine for 1 second if you could be out in the audience and you could direct Sally and Ralph. Then you could go in and say you could be inside of Ralph, and you could look at what Ralph sees of Sally and experiences Sally as she talks, and she hears her ear, you know, everything through Ralph's ears. You would have a different experience to Sally than if you were sitting in the seat, because you'd be seeing it from Ralph's point of view. Now, if you could get up and move out of Ralph and then look at Ralph from Sally's point of view, now you have a completely different experience, especially if Ralph takes his knowledge of being Ralph and moves into Sally and looks back at Ralph and goes, oh, that's how I look when I talk? In other words, what you're doing is you're moving almost as if you could move all the way around a circle of the different kinds of positions that you could be, you know, the different kinds of experiences you could have. One, the person who directs experiences. 2, the person who's in experiences. And 3, somebody looking on from a different point of view, but with the same vantage point. So it helps people understand that there's me who's having my feelings, and when I'm having my feelings, I'm associated, and I'm doing things, and I'm doing my patterns, and I'm doing everything as I normally would do, and I don't know what I don't know. I only know to do what I do, because I'm in me at that moment. And then there's times when we step outside and analyze that and go, well, that was stupid of me to do that. I should never have done that. The idea in an exercise, if you can look back at a behavior you did yesterday and evaluate it, well, the same thing is true. You can do that inside of an exercise by taking different positions, but you can also take different, what we call experiencer positions, where you are the observer, you're the observing, and you're the person directing the whole experience. I mean, it's a marvelous way to enrich your experience. It's like trying on different clothes. It's like trying on different things that you've never tried on before.
Yes, and I think that it goes further than that in the sense that it doesn't just provide benefits during the learning of a given skill. My view is that since one of the central tenets of NLP is behavioral flexibility, is the capacity within each of us to acknowledge when we're about to do something that's less than resourceful, and then to find new information that we weren't paying attention to before, and then choose to change our behavior so as to get a better result. And one of the things that using perceptual positions during the exercise construction, with multiple repetitions, so we get to see, hear, feel, experience an exercise from multiple perspectives, is, and I really hate the use of this word. People in NLP circles use the word install so regularly. it's not really installing, but it's enriching the mind and conditioning us for the future to be able to apply the skill that we've learned, and that while we're applying it, we find it so much easier after the fact, or and during, of course, too, to be able to gather the information from these three different perspectives. So when the exercise is constructed well, it's not only teaching the knowledge of the skill, it's also teaching behavioral flexibility and better information gathering. That's one of the things I think is so profoundly powerful about ensuring that we are given multiple perspectives while we're learning a skill.
And the really important point is it's very difficult to do this alone. It's almost impossible to do it alone because you do your own behaviors. You know, you do your own patterns. Not you specifically, Jonathan, but all of us. While you're doing those, it's hard to be elsewise. That's why these exercises are structured. So, yes, you learn information from each of these positions, but you learn the ability to shift those positions and gain flexibility in that. And then eventually you learn the wisdom of when and how and where to shift those positions so that you do build all sorts of new behaviors into your experience, which you may not have had. You may have done these already, because we all do these. It's part of being human, but not to your advantage. The key is that most people do this stuff to their disadvantage, if at all. You know, but if they're doing it to their disadvantage, we want to take that and turn it into an advantage for them. We want to teach them and allow them to experience. When I say teach, I want to be real careful, too, because we don't really teach anything. We allow a person to be there and be open while we present, and we present in the way that allows most people to get it, you know, and then it's up to them how open they actually are, because, you know, we're not going to force this on you, but we're going to provide all sorts of different opportunities to explore your behavior and others in ways that you or I would not normally do on our own. And that's where the truth is. You can read a book on NLP, you're never going to get this, because you can't, nobody's there to coach you to, wait, what you did right there, what did you do? Oh, pay attention. Where were you? What position were you in? Because you're always coming from, you're going to be coming from your own vantage point.
Agree with that from experience. I mean, I remember spending, let's say, the last couple of months of 1996 and the first, I guess it would be 6 months, because your course was in June of 1997. So a good 8 months I spent aggressively reading every book and listening to every CD I could, or tape at that point. And that was wonderful learning time. But a day or two with the experiences that you were providing was trumping all of that, profoundly. I mean, measurably and profoundly, because of whatever you were doing at the time. Now, of course, I have a much better perspective on what I believe you were doing, and I'm going to have some late-night conversations with you, I'm sure, to see how similar. So
I want to say this, too, but think of this. I, for years, and I'm very reluctant to put out books and things like that, but and the reason for that is because the people read a book, they read a book, and they get information, and then they think they know what it is that they're being talked about. It's like, you know, use the example for years. You don't learn to ride a bike by reading a book. You can read all the books in the world, and you won't understand how to ride a bike. You got to ride the bike in order to ride it. Now, a book may give you tips and techniques and advantages and things for better riding once you've ridden, because then you've had the experience, so you understand what they're talking about. But it's very difficult to just go, okay, I'm going to read a book, and then I'll be able to do this. Now, it's not necessarily the case, you know, if you're following a recipe and you're cooking, and it goes step one, step two, step three, you know, crack the eggs, beat the thing, and all that good stuff. So again, realize there's limits to every example. The examples aren't gospel. They're not the universal truth. They're just an example. But the point being is, you know, when it comes to riding a bike, you don't get it from a book. Now, what a book does is it pre-exposes the brain to certain things. And, you know, like somebody says, I got to read a book on NLP, and they read the book, and then they go, oh, this is fascinating. I want to do a seminar. I really got to get into the seminar now because I've read this book. And another person will say, I don't want to read anything about it. I just want to go do the seminar. I got to do the seminar. And then after the seminar, they go and read books. The point is that people do a multitude of things, and they're not wrong. That's just what they do. But if they always read the book and then come and do the seminar, or if they come and do the seminar and then go read the book, that's what they do. And the seminar is to say, okay, you do that, and you do that well. Now do something that you don't do. do something different. Learn another behavior, learn another strategy, learn another way of doing things so that instead of having to do it the same way all the time, which is streamlined, it's stereotyped, it's quick, and it's easy in many cases, but it's also the basis of limitation. It's also the basis of talent. And when you're stuck because you're doing the same thing over and over again, you need another way to get out. So the key is learning behavioral flexibility so you have multiple ways of doing anything, good or not so good, so that you can get unstuck whenever you're stuck, because primarily you're getting stuck the same way you always get stuck.
Without knowing it, yes.
Well, without knowing, you just find yourself there. Something triggers it, an anchor, something fires it off, and you get angry the same way you always get angry. Sometimes you get more angry, depending on who it is or what it is, but the process is the same. But if you can interrupt that process and you can... you know, like a tributary, something can branch off. You can take that energy that would have gone into anger and put it into passion, put it into enthusiasm, put it into eagerness, put it into excitement, put it into determination, put it into, you know, any number of things. So, but we don't typically, because we're on automatic. We're thinking the same 60,000 thoughts over and over again. We're doing the same thing the way we've always done it, and that's why the definition of insanity is to expect a different result. Thinking you're going to do it differently, you know, that you're going to get a different result when you do the same things over and over again. It's the unconsciousness of the whole process that's the beauty of it, because it's all unconscious. And the only way, if you're sleeping, if you're unconscious, and I come into the room, you don't know that I'm in the room unless you wake up. All right, but I could tell that you're sleeping because I'm in the room and I'm awake and you're asleep. So the person in the seminar is, if you think of it this way, the person who's read the book, they're unconscious and they want to be with somebody who's awake to say, hey, guess what? There's another way to do this. And you haven't even thought of it yet. And not only do you want somebody who can point that out to you, you want to learn how to do that for yourself so that you can do it. You know, in other words, there's still things that I don't know about me that I learn and uncover and encounter every single day. That's part of the process of evolving ourselves. And there's same things with all of those people around. We ain't done yet. The only time we're done is when we're dead. You know, we can't go another step further. So while we're alive, if you really want to find out what it's like to have a juicy and enjoyable and wonderful life and to be able to learn exquisitely about yourself and learn where your foibles are and where your talents are and what you can do to accentuate the good things and overcome the difficulties, then it's not going to come from a book.
I'd like to jump into a couple of specific exercises, if we could.
Sure.
Let's take something that's pretty straightforward, and most people who are at least enthusiasts about NLP would have had some kind of an experience like this, if not read about it and gotten curious about it. Obviously, with NLP and with rapport techniques, we can connect with absolutely anybody more effectively than we could have without NLP. And certainly, if people just leave it to chance in their lives, then there will be some people that they click deeply with and some people that they just don't click with. And of course, with rapport techniques, we have the ability to choose to be more connected to somebody that we might otherwise have had some challenges with, and to get into the right mindset and elicit the right state in ourselves and connect more effectively. Because, of course, starts with state, as opposed to just choosing to do some things externally while we're feeling disconnected. That doesn't work very well. It's not authentic and it's not congruent. But in terms of constructing an exercise, if we had people sitting in front of us, I certainly remember the ways that you constructed exercises, and some of those things, of course, certainly are paramount in any good NLP course. In other words, any good NLP course should teach people rapport or ensure that people coming in have the skills to be able to generate that. We already talked about multiple perspectives. Some of the things that I find in rapport to be essential these days are to teach people how to do cross-matching or cross-mirroring, because thanks to a lot of self-help books and courses, everybody knows about mirroring now. So especially in business environments, where things are a little bit more fast-paced than the, let's say, the therapy office. Obviously, rapport techniques apply to change work. It works one way when you've got two people quietly sitting in an office. So if you've got a larger group setting where things are moving a little bit faster, people are now in the know about direct mirroring. So I've often found that teaching people, let's say, how to oscillate from one cross-matching thing to another tends to be much more difficult to detect consciously, but still have much of the same results. So there's a sequence involved in training that. Let's focus down on construction of an exercise drill to teach people one of the steps in that sequence. In other words, how to teach direct mirroring and how to teach a little bit of influence. And I remember that in the context of three different positions, in other words, someone who is the actor, someone who is the subject, the person, let's say, that the actor is attempting to gain rapport with or influence, and an observer who can coach and give feedback as to whether or not the actor is performing well, and if not, then where, what can they do better. So with three different positions built into the exercise drill, you often constructed these wonderful, wonderful exercises that were between 3 and 6 minutes long. They had three parts to them, and we always started and ended with rapport. And then there was something funky in the middle, and not all of us knew what the other players in an exercise were instructed to do during that middle section. But it was always a fascinating discovery to try and sort for whatever might have been going on. So I have constructed similar exercises, and in setting such an exercise up, I realized that there is a difference between my outcomes for myself as a trainer in observing and guiding students and my desired outcomes for students to discover on their own. Did you have a similar difference between your outcomes as a trainer and your desired results for students?
Well, the short answer is yes. I thought you already said that very well. So, I mean, there are you know, my hope for people is for what they discover and what they're able to do, you know, and trying to find out also, how do I want to say this?
You were creating opportunities for us to expand our awareness, to sort for new things, to observe and attempt to detect patterns.
And what I'm trying to say is I want there to be a point with each exercise where the people are going to get the ahas. They're going to accomplish a goal. The exercise, on the one hand, is easy enough that people can do it and challenging enough that it's not just, you know, a cakewalk kind of thing, that they actually have to stretch and that they have to learn to do something new and that they're going to learn to discover something and that they can find out that if they become more curious, they'll find out more things. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, but what my goals for them are and what my goals are for the outcome of the exercise needs to kind of intermesh with their goals. They need to intersect as well as not intersect. I don't know how to say not intersect. They need to weave together, but they also need to be also kind of at cross purpose while they're at purpose. They need to point in a different direction. They need to be able to see what they wouldn't see, but they also need to see what they wouldn't see if they didn't do it. And I don't know quite how to articulate that at this point. I've got to think about that for a second in order to answer the question.
Mm-hmm.
There's assumptions inside of everything. For example, and I may go off on a tangent here, but think about this. Let me put this out there. You ever, somebody asks you a question, and you start to answer the question, and you answer it. Maybe they let you go on for 30 seconds, or they let you go on for 5 minutes, and you go, and you finish with your answer, and they go, yeah, but that's not what I wanted to know. You didn't really answer my question. And you went, well, I mean, you asked me this, and so I told you that. And they go, yeah, but this, I don't know, what I meant was, and they give you another piece of it. And so you go off on that other piece. And they go, yeah, but no, that's, you're still not there yet. What I'm talking about, you know, and it's kind of like no matter what you do, you're not answering the question. Well, the reason you or I aren't answering the question is because of the assumptions that we have based on the question that is being asked of us. And we think, okay, well, this is how to answer it. But that may not be what they are asking for. And the question becomes, is okay, if that happens, then can you stop instead of going, oh, you idiot, you know, how many times are you going to ask me the same thing? I've answered it, you know, and blame the person for asking the question. Rather, can you stop and go, what is it that I'm lacking? What do I need to know? In order, what is this, where is this person coming from that I've yet to recognize? So that I can actually answer what they're asking. What is it that they're actually asking me? You know, in other words, maybe what I'm hearing isn't what they're asking. And so for people in an exercise, they kind of have to come to that same place inside of any exercise that they're doing, where they go, you know, am I able to kind of open up here and find out what is actually going on, you know, and then, and if I'm not, if I'm missing it, what do I need to do in order to begin to see it? So going back to the thing of, do I have, you know, are there goals for the experiencer, you know, the people in the exercise? Yes. And then is there an overall goal that I have for the exercise? What I'm saying is, it is in the context of that, each person is learning a part of something from where they are, but the overall experience is about rapport. Does that make sense? It goes back to what the bigger picture is. So they're learning elements.
And not just about rapport. That'll be the primary outcome, in the sense of we want them to get more easily connected and to learn to get more connected. Another part of it is, typically, that's one step in a larger sequence as well. So the bigger outcome is, of course, helping them find a new track towards a new way of being in the world. And the rapport is simply a step in that direction. Often, you described how starting from the big chunk and then chunking down from there is wonderful. And, of course, that can translate in terms of a training room into the why being presented first, either directly or metaphorically. I often, when I'm designing courses, do similarly with a different frame. I call it backward chaining. It comes from my AI background, where I begin from the end in mind. And the end is not something specific and concrete. It is a holistic set of capacities and a different way of being. And I work backward from there. And the question I ask is a chunking down question, but it's more a sequential question in terms of what would need to be true in order for us to achieve this state.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, walking backwards from there to the previous step, and you go, and what would need to be true before that in order to enable getting to this point? And what would need to be true before that to enable? So that's,
I love it,
a different way of, but it works nicely.
Oh, absolutely.
In particular, I find it really interesting the way that when you are creating experiences where you are contriving in those three-part exercises, not just three positions, but the three parts where you'd start and end with rapport, but something funky would happen in the middle, you were creating an opportunity for potential conflict or for influence to occur, whereby we were potentially allowing ourselves to become led for a while. And I don't mean led meaning heavy, for those who are listening. I mean have other people lead us and influence us and direct us without our conscious knowledge. The awareness of that was pretty extraordinary. And since leading doesn't always happen, it doesn't always work in every circumstance, that the training process always began and ended with establishing and developing the connection to our peers. And I thought that was also profound. Well, so a student's outcome might be one thing, might be learning how to do X, Y, or Z, and that might be what they're focusing on consciously. But our goal is usually much bigger than that for students. And for ourselves, in terms of the course.
And there's a side to, you know, talking about this, that you don't want to give away before they experience it. There are times, for example, in an exercise where I will say, okay, here's why you want to do this, all right? This is what you're going to get, and this is what you're going to see, and I'm going to point that out, you know, and it may be something. And they do the exercise, and sure enough, they see it, and or they miss it, and or they discover that plus other things. And that's all part of the exercise and the exercise design. There are other times when I'm going to say, go do it and figure out what I'm trying to get you to do. What is it that I wanted you to pay attention to? And I may not say that quite that way, but in other words, one is go into it and find this, and the other one is go into it and find out what you find out. And people will fry on either one of them more than the other. They'll go, oh, God, you know, just tell me why I'm supposed to do it. And other person say, I don't want to know why to do it. I just want to go do it. So, you know, there's a lot of, again, there people come to learning the way they've been used to learning many times. And so the overall goal, I could say of anything, is to free up the mechanism so that they have more ways of doing things that allow them to be more successful in life. Now, rapport, in order to recognize when you have rapport, you should know when you're out of rapport. And some people can't tell when they're out of rapport. And other people can't tell when they're in rapport. And so building an exercise that allows you to experience both those things viscerally, what you feel when you're in and out of rapport, is an important part of that, so they can go, oh, that sucked, or wow, that feels good. Now, people think, well, pacing leads to rapport, and it does, but it also leads to fighting. You know, you say screw you, I say screw you, you say it louder, I say it louder, I give you the finger, you give me the finger back, we're both pacing each other.
Absolutely.
And one's leading.
But it's not going to the outcome that you want. You know, when you're on the highway and you go 55 and somebody comes up next to you and they're driving right along and you go to 58 and they go to 58 and you go to 60 and they go to 60 and you go to 65 and they go to 65 and they go to 70, you know, that's pacing, you know, and leading. But it's not getting you the outcome that you want. And so what do? Well, you either step on the accelerator, you speed up, you change lanes, you slow down, you do whatever, you know, to break that non-productive pattern. People, I mean, you know, people, the basis of fighting is squaring off. You both are adopting similar positions. You know, you're facing each other. You're breathing about the same way. And you're calling each other names with the same kind of velocity and everything. You're pacing. So the key is to, you know, what are you doing it for? Why, you know, why are you doing it? How are you doing it? Are you getting closer to what it is that you want? Can you recognize when you're getting what you want? Do you know when you've gone astray? Now, those are all important elements. But what you're getting while you're doing that is something else, too. You're gaining and hopefully in flexibility and in observational skills. You're beginning to notice and to calibrate to yourself. You're learning a vast array of other things that if I stop and pointed out all the things that you were going to learn out in that particular exercise, it would be counterproductive to you doing the exercise because then you could have read a book and not actually have experienced it but said, well, okay, here, if you do this, you'll get these things. And everybody will say, well, that's good, but then they don't actually experience them. So it's kind of like you cloak what you're doing in what you're doing so that people can discover it and take it with them and own it and make it their own. If you hand it to them, it's like you can feed a fish or you can teach them to fish. I want to teach you to fish, you know. You want to teach people to fish because that's the only way that they're going to leave you alone. Otherwise, they're going to keep coming back and bugging you. And you're going, well, I need another fish. So go get your own fish.
True.
That's a truly benevolent thing, you know, and it gives you peace
of
mind.
Well, a lot of people don't know what kind of fish want, which brings me to my next brief topic, which is another exercise. I mean, obviously we gave one example of a rapport exercise. Let's shift gears briefly to an exercise that we both label something called values elicitation, but ultimately it's about finding out what's important to ourselves and to other people. Because by learning more about what's important to people, we can help them achieve it. We can help them get it. We can help them to become more in alignment. Now, in constructing such an exercise drill where people would learn to ask questions about how people make decisions and what are the emotional criteria that they use in choosing something, obviously there's a set of questions that are asked, and there are some clarifications that can be asked in either direction based upon the kinds of answers one gets back. And the smallest chunk outcome as a trainer I would have is in teaching the skill. That's almost peripheral to the bigger point, because not only are we teaching a skill, but we're also helping them to get to know each other, which is another benefit, because, of course, as the group grows together, they become more profoundly effective in helping each other. But there's a much bigger outcome, and this is connected to how some people have massive, cathartic, wonderful growth experiences at such courses. Many, many people have, and I think you know this all too well, you've seen it too from all the courses you ran, many people find themselves years after they made choices waking up to the fact that their lives aren't aligned necessarily where they want their lives to be, that they aren't necessarily the people they thought they would become. Or maybe they did, but it wasn't what they originally wanted or isn't what they want now. And sometimes these courses are a big wake-up call. And by putting them through exercises, putting them into exercises where they have the experience of finding out, sometimes for the first time in many, many years, what really drives them, they have these unprecedented moments of opportunity to start making better choices about how to get more in alignment with what's important to them. So a values elicitation exercise has those potential outcomes for people.
Oh, sure, sure.
Are there other outcomes you would have as a trainer, either for yourself in guiding people through a values elicitation exercise or for the students?
Well, again, the short answer is yes. What my outcomes are for the students, I mean, I would do this in trainer's track, you know, when we teach people to be trainers, or sometimes in master practitioner, where you go, okay, here's what we did. Now, what do you think it was about? and allow people to begin to examine the different levels of their learning from a simple exercise. And to me, it's one of the things that it's harder for me to talk about and say, this is what I want from people in this particular instance, rather than to let them find it themselves. And to me, it's putting the cart before the horse. Well, I prefer to be artfully vague. I mean, I really do in this particular case. In other words, you got a question that said, what are your larger purposes in doing an exercise about value elicitation other than the actual having people listen and gain, you know?
I got a total of three questions that were asked about what's the point of this exercise, and they named a different exercise in each case.
So what's the point of an exercise?
And there is no the point. There are multiple points. There are multiple outcomes.
Well, and the point is to do it and shut up. I mean, you know, in other words, the point comes from doing the exercise. If somebody asks what the point is before doing it, it's like what I said before. You have to tell them why they need to do it, why they must do it before they do it. Then for that person, frankly, it's probably just valuable to do the exercise without knowing what the point is, because that's something that they're going to always seem to want to have. What is the point of anything? To me, the question is what is the questioner actually asking, or is this a question that they ask all the time, or in what context are they asking the question, or why is it important to them that they have the point to this exercise? Those things, to me, why is it important to you? What's important to you about knowing that? How, and if you knew it, what would it allow you to do or not do differently? Because what you said, I mean, there's so many different points. There's so many different things you could get from an exercise. You could say, well, the point is to get rapport, the point is to lead, the point is to pace, the point is to discover, the point is, I mean, I could go on and on and on. And until somebody actually experiences it, all it is empty words that they either agree to or disagree with. I'll go, well, okay, but I don't really see the need then. Or, well, yeah, okay, I guess, that's good, whatever. I mean this with all due respect. I have lots of questions, and sometimes my questions challenge people. I'm not saying that the person is being provocative or challenging. They're sincerely and interested and want to know. So, you know, I'm not trying to put a spin on it or say that the question is any way wrong. I'm trying to say that just having a blanket question, like what's the point of the exercise? In other words, to point it out, sometimes you're missing what the larger point is. And I could say in the same way, well, value elicitation is a way of adding to your life and to better understanding people and to knowing what to do at a critical time and you know, being able to do all sorts of stuff. But until you actually do it, you won't understand the point. It won't be a personal point. It'll be an informational point. And the difference between an informational point and a point that changes your life is when you actually go through it. And
agreed.
Have that
absolutely
personal aha. And that in there is the point for you to have that aha. This is what it's about. Aha. This is how I use it. Aha. This is how I'm better off if I do this than if I'd make that choice. Aha. I mean, it's all about that personal, you know, moment in which you, the light switches go on, you know, the lights come on in your head and the symbols go off and you go, oh gosh, it's all coming together now. And that point can't be articulated. That point can only be embraced by you when it happens. And so sometimes I want to be artfully vague because it doesn't serve the greater good to just give information about it.
That's okay. I'm, first of all, very comfortable with that. My hope is that people listening to your answer will become increasingly comfortable with it, too, in the sense that not giving away, quote-unquote, the point or the answer from somebody else's perspective makes it about not being spoon-fed, makes it about personal and self-discovery, and that's the value. That's the value right there. And any presentation that spoon-feeds these answers, as opposed to creating opportunities for discovery, is really shortchanging the student significantly. So we've come to pretty much the end of our hour-long talk, and I just wanted to close by reminding listeners that we're going to be in Orlando in 6 weeks together. I'm really looking forward to seeing you. It's been too many years.
Like, yeah, no kidding. It's amazing.
It is amazing. So we've got 12 days of extraordinary discovery planned for folks, and I'm just so looking forward to it. It's going to be an amazing journey, and I hope those who are listening that are getting value from these calls can see how extraordinary it'll be to be there with us and join us and allow us to guide you for a bit and maybe enable some new possibilities for you.
I had an incredible meal. It was awesome. It was wonderful. It was absolutely delicious. It was incredible. You would salivate. And just, it is so awesome. You know, and if I tell you what it is, you know what? You'll never have the experience.
That's true. Wouldn't compare.
I mean, what I'm trying to say is I can describe my dinner, and it's not going to get you to have the same experience. It's not going to have you taste the food, or, you know, you got to actually experience the dinner. What Jonathan and I are talking about is, you know, if you come to the training and you experience the training, you can dive in and you can learn to do things a new way, and you can enhance what you already do well, and you can eliminate some of the things that you don't want to do and that you're tired of doing over and over again, and things that bug you and annoy you. Those are the kinds of things that you can make a difference about in your own life. The overall goal is that you get more juice out of life, more enjoyment out of life, so that you have the firsthand experience of it. Not an accounting, not a tape recording, not a book learning, not somebody's email, but something that you actually experience and live for yourself and take that with you wherever you go for the rest of your life. That's the point of the training, not to just be smarter, because you'll get smarter.
That and to have a sumptuous feast of learning as well.
Right. So
this is going to be a bit of a party, and there's going to be a select group of people that that get the opportunity to train with you for the first time in 10 years plus.
You know, the way I look at it?
That's amazing.
I look at it that the people who are meant to be there will be there. The people who are show up will be the perfect people to show up at that point on the planet at that time, and we're going to have a lot of fun. We're going to have a great time. We really will, and it's going to be unlike.
I can't wait.
Me too. I'm really looking forward to it.
So, for those of you who are with us on the call tonight, thank you very much for listening, and for those of you listening at home, thanks for downloading and listening. I hope you enjoyed the content. And the questions and the answers and the opportunity to learn from Rex and me, and I hope you get something extraordinary from it. Thank you.
Awesome. Well, thank you for this opportunity to chat, and if we can do it again before the program, I'm open to it. I don't know what my schedule. My schedule is incredibly tight, so we'll see what happens. But I've enjoyed being a part of this, and for all the people listening, you know, God bless you. Have a great time. You know, more power to you. I hope you make all your dreams come true. Whether you see us or whether you don't, you know, your life is in your hands. Make it a great one.
Sounds great. Rex, thanks so much for the opportunity. I always enjoy it.
You too, Jonathan. Thank you.